Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we put the fun back in dysfunctional radio. Hi, my name's Trisha, and Trisha's True Crime Radio is brought to you by your local no-kill shelter. Go to www.nokillnetwork.org to find your local no-kill shelter. You could do something as easy as volunteering an hour a week to help. That's www.nokillnetwork.org for your no-kill animal shelter. My unofficial official co-host, Michael, would be here tonight, but he said, you know, I'm not caught up on the JonBenet Ramsey case, and I don't know if I'd have any questions or not. So he's going to be listening, but if he has a question, he'll call in, and I just have a feeling he absolutely might call in. Tonight we have an amazing show for you. It is going to be unbelievable. We have Chief James Kohler. James Kohler wrote the book, on the JonBenet Ramsey case, and we're going to get back to him in just a moment. But first, we've got some good news here. She finally did it. All the lies and the drama and destruction to innocent people's lives, Tawana Brawley is finally being forced to pay restitution, $627 a month, to be exact, to the prosecutor she falsely accused of raping her. Now, you remember Tawana, New York, 1987. She was only 15 years old. She claimed she was kidnapped and raped by six white men. It was horrific. She said they smeared racial slurs on her using dog feces. Well, she claimed she was held for 4 days and raped. Tawana Brawley and her handlers, that included Al Sharpton, also accused a New York prosecutor of being one of those attackers. It was unbelievable. A grand jury found that Brawley flat out lied. End of story. She lied. She is now making her living as a nurse. Good for her. She's doing something worthwhile. But she stands by her rape allegations. She's being forced to pay this restitution. And I know it's not the money, it's the truth. And sometimes you have to wait a long time for the truth to come out. I'm finally glad to see that there's some sort of justice, no matter how small, in the Tawana Brawley case. In my opinion, Tawana was just a kid. Now, granted, now she's old enough to tell the truth, but back then she was just a kid. And the adults in her life, like Al Sharpton, should have to pay up too. And I even have more good news. Yes, I do. Are you ready for this? iHeartRadio. That's www.iHeartRadio.com is an amazing place. It's where you go to listen to all the big radio stations from all over the country. And a very large syndication company has asked Trisha's True Crime Radio to be a part of iHeartRadio. Starting in a few weeks, I will have my own one-hour true crime show on iHeartRadio. And I'm going to have my own day and my own time slot. I don't know the exact details, but it's happening. Now, the syndication company looks for different types of talk radio talent. Then they start them broadcasting on iHeartRadio while they assign someone to work with them to make sure that they eventually become good enough to go national, if they can. You know how a sports team works, right? They have a farm team. A national team has a farm team. Well, that's what this iHeart thing is for radio, for talk show hosts. We're kind of the farm team. The iHeartRadio is the farm team, and they work with us, hopefully, getting us the big job upstairs, a syndication deal. So it's a step in the right direction, absolutely. I'll still be able to do my blog talk show, which I love doing because it's live, and I will keep you posted, but keep your fingers crossed. I'll let you know about iHeartRadio, and it is a step in that direction to a syndicated show. Let's hope and hope that happens. Tonight, Telluride Chief of Police James Kohler joins us. Chief Kohler wrote the most amazing book on the JonBenet Ramsey case. It's called A Foreign Faction, Who Really Kidnapped JonBenet, and it's now available in Kindle version on Amazon. And Chief Kohler, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for the invitation.
You're welcome. My screen froze here for just a moment. I'm going to see if I can get everybody back up here. There we go. Okay, Cold Case, are you there, my darling?
Yes, I am.
Okay, I'm going to put you on hold. I just took you off hold to tell you I'm going to put you on hold, okay? So hang on,
okay.
We'll be going to you in just a moment. And Cherokee will be going to you in just a moment as well. But first, we're going to talk to Chief Kohler for just a little bit, and then we'll be taking some questions and some calls. Chief Kohler, it's been a while since you've joined us. Now, this Tuesday, it would have been JonBenet's 23rd birthday. That is very hard to believe. But it's true. She would have been 23 years old. Did you know that? Did you remember that, Chief Kohler?
Yes, I did.
Does it seem amazing to you that this much time has passed?
It does, actually. When you think about all the things that have come in between now and then, there's been a lot of history and a lot of coverage of this case. But, one more year goes by and you think about how old she was if she'd survived this attack.
It's sad. Another year goes by that we don't know the truth and we can't find out what happened. But the great thing about your book, Chief Kohler, is it is by far the book that details the most information and the most truth. Chief Kohler, give us just a little bit of background for those of us joining us for the first time. You're an old friend of our show, but give us a little bit of background. You wrote this book because you know a lot about the JonBenet Ramsey case. Tell us how that came about.
Well, I spent 17 years with the Boulder Police Department from 1976 to 1993 and knew many of the primary investigators involved in the case. And that murder took place 3 years after I had left the department. I went to the mountain resort community of Telluride in fall of 93. I had to be the chief for the municipal police department there. And so I was gone at the time in 96 when this murder took place. A number of years later, I kind of semi-retired from law enforcement and I took a position with the Boulder District Attorney's Office as an investigator in 2004, and the following year I was asked to step into the chief investigator's position for the investigative unit at the DA's office, and with that position came the responsibility of being the lead investigator for the JonBenet case. The DA had taken on the lead role from the Boulder Police Department a number of years earlier when Mark Beckner gave up the case. Mm-hmm. So it was that time that I became most intimately familiar with the reports and things as I assumed that responsibility. I left the DA's office in the spring of 2006. Telluride had recruited me back as the chief, and so I've been there ever since. I returned to the mountains in 2006.
Chief Kohler, you left the DA's office. You tried to investigate the JonBenet case. You left after 4 months, like you said, but basically the writing was on the wall. Tell us why you left as much as you can, because it wasn't just, hey, I want a change of scenery. There was very specific reasons, and I believe it had to do with the JonBenet case, or am I speaking out of turn here?
Well, I had presented information, some new information that I had unearthed during my investigation as a lead investigator in the case, and presented that to the then DA Mary Lacey and some of her command staff. That was in January of 2006. And I had suggested some leads that I thought needed to be pursued, and it was clear from my presentation I didn't believe an intruder was responsible for the crime. And there was no interest in pursuing any of the things that I thought we could look further into, try to get answers to some remaining questions. And that was part of the reason I decided to leave, that it just wasn't going to go any further than that. So as I indicated in my book, I'd been recruited. The recruitment had started back in late December. So I was seriously considering going back to Tyre part of that time, but that certainly was a big motivating factor for me as well.
Chief Kohler, why did they bring you in? They must have known what type of man you are. You are going to look at the facts. You didn't come in with any preconceived notion. Like you said, you weren't even there when the crime happened. Why in the world did Mary Lacey, the DA at the time, bring you in and basically, these are my words, not yours, thumbed her nose at what you were attempting to do?
Well, I never had any thoughts about ever becoming involved in the Ramsey case when I first went there in 2004 mm-hmm. to investigate. Tom Bennett was the chief investigator for the unit at the time, and he'd been hired part-time specifically to work the JonBenet case a couple years prior, and then it evolved into a full-time position. I was hired, I think, specifically in 2004 to come in and fill an investigator's position, and I had a number of ties to a number of law enforcement agencies there in the county as well as the metro area based on my prior 17 Boulder. So I think it was the intention for me to come in and help mend fences with some of the agencies, reestablish communication and relationships with the agencies in the area as a former cop who'd worked there for a number of years. And it was only the following year, in 2005, when Tom Bennett decided to retire and they asked me to step into that position. So it was kind of a surprise to me, I think, as well as the DA's office, that I would end up in that position as a lead investigator in that case.
So it just kind of evolved. It wasn't like you were brought in specifically for that. It just kind of happened. And
that's
interesting. You were brought in to try and mend fences because, boy, those fences, they were obliterated. It wasn't just a knockdown. It was a Hiroshima of obliterating those fences. I mean, the DA wasn't talking to the the cops and everybody. Oh, it was just a mess. But the good news is you were able to pull a case together and bring out some information that hadn't been brought out before. And that is kind of what your book is about. It's also about the politics that goes on in Boulder. But most of the people listening tonight, not all, but most of them have a pretty good sense of the JonBenet Ramsey case. We've been together, a lot of us, since the very beginning of this case. That's what brought me to the internet, was the JonBenet Ramsey case. So we'll probably jump back and forth. We'll be talking about things that maybe a lot of us listening now, old news to us, but it's going to be brand new news to other people who don't know as much about the case. But I'm going to jump ahead here, and we won't talk about the actual what happened immediately that night. I want to talk about the pineapple in JonBenet. Now, this is a big source of contention with Wendy Murphy. Do you know Wendy Murphy?
No, I'm afraid I don't.
She's been a prosecutor. She's very outspoken. I quite like her. She's actually brilliant. She is on the Today Show a lot. She's always on Nancy Grace. And I love her, and I normally agree with what she says, but occasionally, and this is the only way I can describe it, occasionally she'll be talking about something and sounding brilliant, and then all of a sudden it will be like she starts talking about the Keebler elves and how they're real. You're just like, what the hell did you just say? And she kind of did that at the end of my show last week, talking about the pineapple in that JonBenet ate, that apparently at some time after she got up out of bed and right before she was killed. First of all, do we have an idea of the time frame? Just, I know it's just general, between when JonBenet ate the pineapple and when the actual event, the killing happened. Any sort of time frame there?
Well, from the reports that I reviewed, they were looking at somewhere between a 45-minute and perhaps an hour and a half, upwards of possibly 2 hours. And that was based on what they're thinking was the time of ingestion of the pineapple, coupled with the traveling through her digestive tract, as well as the amount of blood and swelling, the edema of the brain after the blow to the head. So, we may get to the theory about how I think some of those events evolved that would further explain that and further explore the question you're asking. But those are the time frames that I put in my book that were provided by some of the medical experts that were interviewed and consulted with by the Boulder Police Department.
Okay, so, and we will get to that whole sequence of events. It's just everybody is chomping at the bit to talk about what Wendy said. Basically, and I just want to make sure that I'm getting it correctly here, because it was just very strange. Let me get to my notes here. Oh, great, my computer froze. That's lovely. Okay. Well, basically, she said that there was some benzoids in JonBenet's system, and that she was drugged by the parents, and the drug was put in the pineapple. Now, the tox screen showed no benzoids, no Valium, no nothing. And when I presented that to Wendy after the show. This was in an email exchange. She said that the tox screen did not test for those type of benzoids. It's my understanding, Chief Kohler, that that's one of the main things they test for, especially in a case like this, to see if the child's been drugged. Is that correct?
Well, I have to tell you, Tricia, that I don't have any of those documents in front of me. It's been quite some time since I've looked at those autopsy findings. There is a certain screening panel that a tox screen will typically be used when you're doing that type of inquiry. I can't tell you right off the top of my head, but my thought is, based on what you've told me, is that the amount of pineapple was so small that I doubt that that amount of fruit would have contained enough of a narcotic to have rendered her unconscious. And I don't know what the purpose of that would be, and it seems like if there was something present in her system that would have knocked her out, as I think is being suggested, that would have shown up in the tox screens that were performed by the pathologist.
Absolutely. Like I said, it was just so bizarre, and I think everybody that was listening was absolutely stunned, and that's why we have a lot of people in our chat room right now, because they want to see what the heck's going on, because it was just a very, very strange thing. I apologize. My computer has totally frozen. I can't even see the chat room. I can't see anything. So let's see. Hold on here. Let me try and get onto the show another way. She said that the reason why she had a head injury is that somebody shook her really hard to try and wake her up from this benzoid fog that she was in. There was no petechia from shaking, I don't believe. There's never been anything to suggest that she was shaken, has there?
The petechia was from the strangulation in her eyes. And the swelling and the bleeding in your brain was caused by the blow to the head by a blunt object, which I believe to be the flashlight. We'll
right.
delve into that here shortly, but I don't think the amount of shaking that would have been required to cause that type of damage would show up. I mean, I think it's the head injury based on that blunt force trauma from an instrument that caused the bleeding.
And she did claim she had an inside info of some sorts, and I don't know what this is. And this, I don't mean to trash Wendy. I, like I said, I love her. I have her on my show. It was just so bizarre, and I wanted to clear some of that up. And we'll probably get back to that in just a little bit when my computer unfreezes and I can get to my notes. And also, hopefully, Cynic will be joining us because he wrote an incredible rebuttal to that on both WebSleuth.com and ForumsForJustice.org. But let's get back to your theory of the crime and the pineapple and the flashlight. Because to me that is absolutely fascinating, and I'm going to give just the briefest outline. The parents and JonBenet and Burke come home. There's some discussion whether she was carried upstairs, whether she walked upstairs. She was in bed. At some point her clothes were changed. She was brought downstairs, given pineapple, ended up in the basement with the head wound. And there was a mag flashlight found on the kitchen counter that had been wiped clean, including the batteries. Now, to me, there's only one reason why you wipe clean the batteries, and that is you don't want your fingerprints. Hello? But if that was a murder weapon, and this is rhetorical, actually, I don't know why they just didn't throw it out. Maybe in the hectic situation, they just couldn't. But that's the very basic outline. Am I correct, Chief Kohler, on the crime?
Well, there's a little bit more to it than that, Tricia, and obviously it involves some speculation when you go to interpreting human behavior as well as some of the physical evidence involved. I think there's a little more background information about the flashlight that was not provided for in the book, and then I also think that there's a nexus, which is kind of a hinge point for the pineapple, which might explain how some of the events took place that evening. And I'm happy to
let's
go
talk about
some
that.
Stuff.
Yes, let's talk about that. You say there's some more information about the flashlight. That's good news to me. Let's hear it.
Well, I have to put this a little bit in perspective and context.
Sure.
You know, when I kind of eliminated one by one the pieces of evidence that people were pointing to as evidence of an intruder being involved. Once I kind of discounted those on my own investigative theory, I started looking at, well, you know, if an intruder's not involved, how could the family be involved? What would be the motive? What would be the reason? And who, in particular, would be involved in the events that took place that evening? And something that did not make my book was comments that had been elicited during the June 98 interview with Burke that had taken place by the Broomfield detective.
Mm-hmm.
And this was an interview, if I recall, that took place about an hour a day over the course of 3 days, if I remember correctly. And during some of the comments or questions that came up, there was a discussion about a cubbyhole storage place up in his parents' bedroom where luggage was kept and stored.
Mm-hmm.
And Burke spoke about being kind of familiar with that space, and it was kind of mysterious the way he seemed to reference it. And I got to thinking about some of the things that were taking place that night as the family prepared to go to Michigan, as well as their follow-up trip on the Disney trip. And there was crime scene video of the house that was shot on the evening of the discovery of JonBenet's body. And there was an open suitcase that was filled mostly with clothes in Patsy's master closet upstairs. It was open. You could see that there were clothes in it. The flashlight, if I recall from the interviews, had been stored in one of the drawers in the kitchen area. It was my thought, when I was trying to consider how events had unfolded, that perhaps Patsy had used that flashlight to go digging in that cubby storage to locate suitcases or a suitcase for the trips that they were planning to take, and that she had returned the flashlight downstairs after retrieving whatever she needed, and it just never got put back into the kitchen drawer. And it remained out and was still out that evening after the family had returned home from the white Christmas party. So it was readily available and accessible there in the kitchen. My thought was that, you know, boys being boys, Burke may have been playing with the flashlight when he was having pineapple that evening after the return from the party.
Mm-hmm.
That's a little bit of context and background about the flashlight and how it might have been left out and accessible in the kitchen later that evening.
So,
go
ahead. No, I want to hear what you believe me. It's much more important what you have to say than what I have to say. Go for it.
Okay. Well, do you have a question more about the flashlight?
No. Okay. No. Please continue.
Well, I've raised three children. My thought is that if you're coming home from a party, you've been out for a good part of the evening, you've been up all day long, I suspect that JonBenet truly was asleep in the back of the car. She'd been up early that day and playing hard, and was sound asleep when the family finally got home after leaving the White's party. They had stopped a couple places to deliver some Christmas presents and got home. And I know there's probably some aspects of some truth that perhaps the parents talked about, but as I'm trying to formulate a theory about how events took place, this is what I was thinking. You know, if my daughter or my son had been wetting the bed pretty consistently, I don't think I would just throw them in bed when we got home. I would probably get them up to use the toilet before turning into the night, especially knowing that we were going to be getting up early the next morning to travel. And you wouldn't have time to do laundry or throw in any sheets,
mm-hmm.
And get them to the dryer as well. So my thought was that JonBenet, after she was asleep, that John carried her upstairs and placed her on the bed. And I know he had talked about playing with Burke a little bit with a toy before turning in, but my thought was that he probably wanted to get to bed pretty early because he was going to help co-pilot the flight the following morning.
Mm-hmm.
So he took a sleep aid and turned in, the expectation being that Patsy would be up to finish getting JonBenet ready for bed. I think Patsy and Burke, I think it's possible, based on the fingerprint evidence, that they stopped in the kitchen and that she laid out the last of the fresh pineapple in the house for him. There are fingerprints on the tea glass as well as in the pineapple bowl that would suggest that took place. There's no indication that the pineapple had ever been served earlier. And I think when you look at the evidence about the pineapple being in JonBenet's stomach, that that is a point of contact, a nexus of contact between Burke and JonBenet that could have taken place after they got home that evening.
Okay, so let's look at this. Let's make sure I understand what you're saying. Chief James Kohler, author of A Foreign Faction, Who Really Kidnapped JonBenet, talking about the JonBenet-Ramsey case. So we know Burke's fingerprints are on the bowl of this fresh pineapple. We know the pineapple ends up in JonBenet's digestive tract, a very small amount. There is a connection between brother and sister connecting up at that point sometime after they came home. Is that what you're inferring here? I think that's that's an easy jump. That's an easy assumption to make. It's obvious.
That's how it could be interpreted, yes.
Okay.
But my thought is that Patsy went upstairs, that she, after serving pineapple to Burke, that she went upstairs to get JonBenet up. She roused her, got her off the bed, got her into the bathroom. That's where she stripped off her red sweater and left it on the counter there. There. In the crime scene photographs, you see that there's a toothbrush and toothpaste out, not depicted in my book or version of events. There's a photograph of the toilet, which appears to have been used as well. So my thought is, JonBenet is up. She's been instructed to use the toilet, to brush her teeth perhaps, change. Although she didn't get to that point, I don't think she ever got into her nightgown as probably instructed by Patsy. But by that time, she's up, she's alert, she's awake, and she's hungry because, by all accounts, she had nothing to eat at the white Christmas party, dinner party.
Mm-hmm.
So at that juncture, she goes downstairs, and that's when I think there's this point of contact that could be construed based on the pineapple evidence and fingerprint evidence downstairs in the kitchen.
So JonBenet's fingerprints are not on the bowl, right, or on the spoon, if I remember correctly?
They're not. It's just Patsy and Burke's on those two pieces of kitchenware.
And anybody who has kids knows that they can, especially a little sister and a big brother, boy, I'm just picturing that at my house, and I can see me running up and grabbing a piece and putting it in my mouth and my brother getting really upset. Anyway, I do have a couple of questions here, and then we're going to go to one phone call, but we talked about the red sweater that we found balled up in the bathroom. What about the jumpsuit? Wasn't there a jumpsuit soaking in the sink as well? This comes from Chelly from websleuth.com.
I remember hearing about that question, but I can't tell you off the top of my head if I remember reading
it. I can't remember. I can't remember about the jumpsuit either. That's why I was kind of stunned. So anyway, Patsy did. Now, there was urine found on the clothing, though, right? Or is that just something that we assume, or that we've just assumed all these years?
Well, no, the underwear and the leggings, if I recall, had urine in them in the front, as if she was laying
right
on her stomach.
Right. I'm sorry. That's what I was thinking of. You're right. Yes, she was found with it. Okay, that's absolutely right. Okay, thank you to Chelly from that. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Chief Kohler.
Well, I'm saying that, yes, there was urine in the underwear as well as in the leggings, and they were in the front, if I recall, of her, as if she were on her stomach when she urinated.
Interesting, being on your stomach. Okay, let's go to a call really quick here. I believe we have my unofficial official co-host, if it will happen, Michael in Minnesota. Michael, do you have a question for Chief Kohler?
Yes, thank you. I want to go back to more of the Wendy Murphy discussion, if we may.
Sure.
She asserted, Chief, that the benzos were part of this ongoing drugging that was taking place of JonBenet for the purpose of using her sexually in some form of sexual assault, pedophilia. Her accusations were really quite wild and very, she spoke like she had proof about this, but when we asked her about the autopsy, she couldn't cite any kind of findings or report that she had gotten the information about benzos. But do you have you in your investigation, did you come upon any sort of evidence that would substantiate claims of using JonBenet in a sexual manner for whatever purpose it may be, from pedophilia to making films, whatever?
Nothing of substance that I ever saw. I knew there were rumors about that that were, you know, populated by some of the people following the case, but I never saw anything of substance that suggested there was any truth to that.
And again, that
Thank
is
you.
My version of the Keebler elves. Michael, I'm going to put you back on hold, but we'll come back to you in a bit, okay, my dear?
Fine, whatever.
Okay, hold on. Let's take a question here really quickly from Cherokee. And Cherokee, we have Chief Kohler on the line. We're kind of hopscotching around the case of the JonBenet Ramsey case. Did you have anything you'd like to ask Chief Kohler before I continue?
Yes. I was wondering why he has his version of the events, which closely matches mine, but his more take place in the kitchen area than the basement. Could it not have also happened that Burke and JonBenet were having this pineapple snack or whatever, and then he decides to go down and mess with some of the Christmas presents that they know are down there to be taken to Charlevoix or open something early, and she follows him down there, and she starts messing with his stuff or whatever, and then he grabs a nearby, which there were several sets of, including junior golf clubs, grabs a golf club out of one of the nearby sets in his anger or whatever, and causes a head injury with a golf club, because it does seem to be consistent with that, instead of the flashlight. And my question is, why do you tend, from what you can say, I know there's not everything you can reveal, why do you tend to think it was the flashlight that would have had to have been turned sideways instead of a golf club or something like that that would have been actually in an arc from his arm instead of sitting sideways of her running away or whatever? Why do you think it was the flashlight instead of a golf club, and why do you think it took place in the kitchen and not the basement?
Good question.
There's a lot that goes into the thought processes for that. And again, Cherokee, it's a matter of speculation. But I think that the nexus of contact between the two is pineapple in the kitchen. That, as Tricia indicated, that it's not unheard of for siblings to have some type of conflict regarding those types of things, and that if she snatched a bite from his pineapple bowl, that may have made him mad. If you follow the sequencing of injuries that Dr. Werner Spitz suggests, then following that bite of pineapple, there might have been a grabbing of the T-shirt that she was wearing at the time and a twisting of that around the throat. That accounts for the bruise on the front side of her throat by the larynx. There's some indication of some fingernail scratches there. Perhaps she was trying to loosen up that grip. When that is finally let go, the flashlight is handy where it's being played with there in the kitchen. She turns away, and just at the right angle, as Burke demonstrated during his interview with Dr. Bernhardt, he provides an over-the-head striking blow. Now, you know, if you consider human behavior and you look at some of the things that are suggested through his demonstration of that, you know, you play that into a theory that might play out plausibly for the series of events that took place there.
Let's talk about that interview that Burke had with the doctor. You said he demonstrated. Can you please elaborate on that? He was being interviewed by a psychologist, psychiatrist, I believe. I'm not sure. Give us the sequence that leads up to this demonstration.
Well, he was being interviewed by a psychiatrist from the Department of Social Services within about a week and a half after the murder. And he was asked at one point if he knew what had happened to JonBenet. And as I outline in one of the chapters of the book, he provides some inconsistent information about what was believed to have been known to him at the time. And at one point, he speaks about either a blow to the head with a hammer or being stabbed. And he demonstrates twice with his right arm an over-the-arm shoulder blow, which would be entirely consistent with a blow, one-handed blow with the flashlight. I'm not sure if Tris has shared this with you, but several months ago I shared some information from a book that Dr. Werner Spitz had written, where he had some diagrams of the hand injury for John Binet as well as the flashlight, and they match up pretty consistently, much more so than a golf club. And so when I look at the evidence at hand in the kitchen that's readily available, along with the nexus with the pineapple, that's what seems to make sense to me if you're trying to figure out a theory of events as to how things occurred.
Very interesting.
I'd like to go back one other thing that Cherokee was asking about, the presents. The presents were torn open much earlier in the day, before the family went to the white dinner party. It was not that night. So I know there's been a lot of talk and discussion about the possibility of a golf club being used, possibly because of the prior injury that had been sustained back in Michigan when Burke was swinging the club.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the nature of the injury, the nature of how blunt force trauma injuries are sustained by skulls and that bone, I think once you look at that evidence as depicted by Dr. Spitz, it's pretty convincing for me as far as what weapon was used to inflict that blow to her head.
And is that available in your Kindle version now?
It is not. You know, I wish I had sought permission to use that previously. And it's a pretty extensive text. He is, as I say, he's really kind of an expert on physical trauma and wounding and things like that. And there's a whole chapter devoted to blunt force trauma and quite a few things about skull injuries. And it's pretty compelling evidence, in my opinion, when you look at the flashlight and the injury that occurred to John Binet's head.
It certainly is. And we do have that up, I believe, on Forums for Justice, if I'm not mistaken, or we will get it up very shortly if we don't have it already. Have you heard from Lynn Wood? That is the Ramsey's attorney. And he was a pit bull when it came to defending Burke. And let me just talk about that for just a moment, and then I'll re-ask my question. Burke, early on, was cleared by Alex Hunter, the prosecutor. However, if you read the piece of paper that Alex Hunter put together, clearing Burke, what it says, basically, and I'm paraphrasing, is up until this date, whichever date it was in 1997 or whenever, there is no evidence to indicate Burke Ramsey is involved in the crime. So he left. Alex Hunter did one very small thing, right? And that was he left the door open in case other evidence comes up. Hypothetically, and this is all hypothetical, this is just our opinion, we're not accusing anybody, but hypothetically, Chief Kohler, what would happen if Burke came forward now and said, you know what, I did it?
Well, as I think I've indicated during one or the second interview, it's a very complicated legal landscape. In Colorado, a child needs to be 10 years of age under the law to form intent to commit a crime. And Burke was, you know, a couple weeks away from being 10 at the time that this murder took place. So as a 9-year-old, almost 10, he would not be able to be charged under Colorado law for any type of criminal conduct. And so even if he came forward today and admitted involvement or, you know, being the perpetrator of this, he would not probably be charged because he was of too young an age at that time under Colorado law to be charged.
Let's go to one of our other callers. This is our very loved and adored Cold Case. Cold Case, are you with us, my dear?
I am.
Okay, Cold Case, do you have a comment or a question for Chief Kohler? And then may I ask him one question first, and then I'll go to you.
Sure.
I'm sorry, I just thought of this. Have you heard from Lynn Wood, the attorney that defended the Ramseys, did a great job, but he went around suing anybody that mentioned Burke. Have you heard a peep out of him?
I have not. The only comment I recall hearing at the time was that they believed the DNA would identify a perpetrator or perpetrators, and that's about as much as he had to say.
Interesting.
But I've never heard personally from him.
Very interesting, because your book is the go-to book for this case, and I would think after all of his blustering, he would be very upset, but the fact that he hasn't said anything, very compelling. Okay, Cold Case, it is your turn, my dear. You have the floor with Chief Kohler, who wrote the book, A Foreign Faction, who really kidnapped JonBenet. Please, Cold Case, go ahead.
Well, in relation to some things that other people have asked and your current discussion, the issue Wendy brought up last week of the drugging, her ideas of drugging the pineapple and some type of nefarious activities going on with sexual abuse of the child prior to the night she was murdered, I would like to ask you, Chief Kohler, if you know of any other evidence besides the chronic vaginal inflammation mentioned in the autopsy that would speak to prior molestation by someone of the child.
Well, I think the evidence that was reviewed by some of the pathologists who looked at the autopsy photos and such afterwards indicated that they thought there's more than one incident of sexual contact with JonBenet that took place on the evening of evening or day of her murder. And they couldn't say how many times or how frequent or what duration it took place, but the consensus was that they felt that something had been taking place sexual contact-wise prior to the murder event. And that was outside the scope of the paintbrush being used to inflict the injury at her hymen, the vaginal orifice. So those were the things I think that came into play, and some of the things I discussed in some chapters of the book about prior injuries that suggested some type of sexual contact was taking place. And I personally don't believe that that had anything to do with any pedophilia or any sexual things that's sometimes been suggested by people. I don't think there's anything in any of the record to support that type of suggestion. I think it's more simple than that, and outline that in some of the findings in the book.
I think you're right in all that I have been able to study and research about the case. It seems to imply to me that it was just someone close to her in her inner circle who had access to her, but it certainly would go a good distance towards stamping out the idea that there was an intruder who somehow was able to get to her without any of her relatives, parents, or herself speaking, knowing about this, or her speaking about it. So that's why, to me, that is a very important issue. And I have one question about when you mention that you can postulate that the head blow was struck in the kitchen with the flashlight. If that were the case, here's my next question. So if she were felled in the kitchen, how would she have gotten to the location by the paint tray outside the cellar door? Because that's a staircase. That's picking her up and carrying her, because if she were dragged, say, by Burke, it seems like there would have been a good bit of physical evidence of that. And it's just, you know, from my own experience with children, that he probably would not have been able to pick her up and carry her that distance downstairs. So what is your idea or theory about how she then got to that paint tray?
Well, I've wondered a lot about that myself, Cold Case, and trying to figure out, you know, if the blow took place in the kitchen and she was down and unconscious, then how did she get to the basement near the paint tray and then her eventual location in the wine cellar? And You know, if you recall, there was at least one abrasion that I can recall off the top of my head that was on one of her shoulders that looked like it might have been some type of scraping abrasion. I can't remember if there was something else on her lower legs. You know, Burke had indicated in his interview with Dr. Bernhardt that he believed someone had picked her up and carried her downstairs. Now, he was, you know, quite a bit taller than her. You know, is it reasonable to believe that a 10-year-old could have moved a 40-pound dead weight down a flight of stairs? Could he have put her on a blanket and drug her down that way? That would be much easier. You know, it's hard to say, you know, and obviously it's all a matter of speculation as to how she got from the kitchen down to the basement, if that's where the initial blow was struck and she was unconscious. That's a tough one grapple with.
That is a tough one. Cold case, did you have any follow-up?
Yes. Okay, this brings me back to the pillowcase on her bed in her bedroom. In the 98 interview between Haney and Patsy, there is a good bit of questioning about blood found on the pillowcase on JonBenet's bed. And then the follow-up questions Haney asks of Patsy are, did she have nosebleeds? So that they never specifically say it's her blood, but it's certainly implied through the questions, between the lines, that it was JonBenet's blood on the pillowcase and that possibly it had been identified with mucus because he asked if she had nosebleeds, which Patsy said no. And then they get into a long discussion about when the sheets were last changed. So are you following me on that? Are you aware of that piece of evidence?
I am cold case, but it's been just too long since I've looked at that interview, and I'm afraid I'd hate to misstate something and say something incorrectly if I can't remember exactly what those details were.
Well, I guess I was just wondering what would you think about how that blood then got there, and, you know, would be rather a coincidence that this pillow at the murder scene, that this pillow the victim slept on, which had her blood on it, you know, had nothing to do with her death shortly thereafter. So I just wondered if that location of that pillow and that blood on that pillow might have suggested something to you.
You know, certainly it's within the realm of possibilities. You know, my recollection is that there was no bleeding from the head wound and that the discharge from her nose was more mucus than it was blood. I don't recall ever reading anything about nosebleeds that she may have had. I don't know what could have caused that on the pillowcase. I do remember as well that although the photographs didn't depict it, the investigators who were there at the scene could smell urine on the sheet. So I don't remember when it was that they had been changed prior to their investigation of the scene, but it seemed apparent that there was urine present there as well.
Cold case, any more follow-up?
Thank you.
Any more follow-up?
Well, thank you for answering those questions, Chief Kohler. I guess that was really on the topics that we've been going over, the ones I had, but I did have a question about the phone records, which is something I'm kind of known for harping on because it's just so phenomenal to have a murder of this type with the media exposure and the level of investigation that was done on this case, and for the phone records of the family to never have been subpoenaed. So at least that's the stories that we've heard. We've heard that the Ramseys turned in fragments of their records a year or so later, and that Hunter was the one who basically blocked the phone records being subpoenaed, according to Steve Thomas. But I wondered if you if you knew that if they actually had ever been subpoenaed later in the investigation. You know, there's a case of a man named James Rapp, I think his first name was James, who actually was prosecuted for illegally obtaining those phone records. And I always imagine that they're sitting in the evidence room in the Boulder Police Department somewhere with the one clue that would break the whole case. If the Ramseys, say, theoretically, had used the phone before they called 911 to make calls that would expose them, you know, not telling the complete truth about the events of that night. So I wondered if you knew if those phone records had ever eventually gotten subpoenaed.
Well, subpoena indicates a grand jury investigation versus a prosecution where things could be subpoenaed for records, duplicates taken. So I wouldn't be able to comment on any subpoenas being issued. But, you know, as Steve indicated, you know, their attempts to get all kinds of different types of records, including credit card records and bank records, those were turned down by the DA's office when police investigators presented those affidavits. So I don't recall hearing that any of those records were turned in later. That's very possible. Like I, you know, I've said before, this is an extensive library of materials, and I didn't get to each and every piece of it, but I looked at what I thought were the core documents. But I'm not sure if those records would really show anything unless it's from a cell phone, because unless you're making a long-distance call, those are really, truly not going to be documented.
It's not going to show up. Exactly. We're talking with Telluride Police Chief James Kohler. James Kohler wrote the definitive book on the JonBenet Ramsey case. It's called A Foreign Faction, Who Really Kidnapped JonBenet? And let's talk about the grand jury. That was a shocker. When the grand jury, we found out through, finally, after all these years, a couple of grand jurors came forward and they hid their identities and said, yes, we voted to indict the parents. I understand that we should be able to get the grand jury testimony now is how I look at the law. And when I say me, I mean others have pointed it out to me. Cynic is the one who came up, and I hope he calls in. Cynic is the one that found the law that basically says when there is an indictment, the information needs to be released. Chief Kohler, do you have any comments or thoughts on this?
Well, you know, Seneca and I think exchanged some emails earlier this spring about that, not long after Charlie Brennan released that article. And I've been on the road and I haven't been able to look at my documents, but it seems to me, if I remember the law correctly, that if an indictment has been issued, that two bill has been returned, and typically that is released back to the public. And then, you know, perhaps the DA didn't feel, you know, that he could prosecute it, I mean, which is what, you know, essentially Alex Hunter said without saying anything about the indictment or anything about the final conclusion of the DA or the grand jury meetings. He just indicated he didn't think there were sufficient grounds to pursue charges. So, you know, I'd really have to look at the law to find out what that is, and hopefully Cynic will call in and chat about that. It's just been too long since I've looked at that, but I think
I'm telling Cynic is brilliant, and he really, it seems pretty, and I'm just a layperson when it comes to the law, Chief Kohler, but it seems pretty, I wish I had it in front of me, and I should have, but it just seems pretty downright basic. Hey, it's, you know, this is what you can get, and if there is an indictment returned. I do have a question from the chat room from Ollie, too. Do you think the blow to JonBenet Ramsey's head came first, or it came before or after the strangulation?
Well, which, if you look at Dr. Spitz's sequencing events, he thinks that the strangulation or part of the twisting of the shirt around her collar, I guess you could say that was an initial choking or strangulation. And then the head blow came, and then it was sometime after, in that time period of maybe 45 minutes to an hour and a half to 2 hours, where the garrote was finally applied, and that ended her life. That gives the amount of time for the blood from the brain injury to fill the cavity of the skull and begin to affect brain death, and as well as the breathing and such.
Understood. And I do have a question from the chat room. And Michael, I'll be coming to you in just a moment. We also have a caller that I will be chatting with here in just a minute. But I need to get to the chat room. My stupid computer froze up. When do you think, Chief Kohler, when do you think the sexual aspect of this case took place? Was that just part of the staging? You know, the what was found and the slivers of wood inside of her. Was that just part of the staging to make it look like there was a sexual act going on?
Again, Tricia, I think that's all speculation. You could say that perhaps it was part of the abuse that might have been taking place beforehand, or more severe abuse, given the final acts of the strangulation. There were a lot of elements of staging. It's hard to say whether or not that particular aspect of the injuries was staging, or if that was part of the other assault that was just taking place because of the events taking place that evening.
Yeah, and you're right. And this, there's so much speculation here. And the problem is all of the speculation, totally legit, not all of it, but a lot of it is totally legitimate, and it could absolutely fit into the crime. I need to go to a caller, and then, Michael, I'll go to you next. This is area code 720, area code 720. You've been on hold a long time. Do you have a question for Chief James Kohler about the JonBenet Ramsey case?
Is that me?
That's you.
Okay, great. Chief Kohler, thanks for battling the progressive culture of Boulder. You all are missing a very interesting case. Patsy killed JonBenet deliberately. No one else was involved. There was no staging for police. Everything that was done by Patsy for Patsy. The key to understanding the case is the signature of the case, and that is the literature tied to this case. Everyone knows about the speculation early on by investigators of the role of books and movies in the contents of the ransom note. What people don't know is the number of facts in the case that also show up in the works of Muriel Spark, particularly the crime with Miss Jean Brody. Everyone knows that there is pineapple found in JonBenet's proximal intestine and a bowl was found in the home. But people don't know that there was milk or cream in the bowl. And in one paragraph in the crime of Miss Jean Brody, there is a tea party that two of the students have where pineapple is served in a bowl with cream. They eat it with spoons. All of those facts are part of the case, and there are many more.
Hold on, Brother Moon. Hold on just one second. Chief Kohler, has there ever been any evidence that there was milk in the pineapple bowl?
Not that I've seen.
I don't think so. Yeah,
I don't think it was mixed with anything. It was just pure pineapple in the bowl.
That's all there was pure pineapple in the bowl. So, yeah, I know that's your theory, Brother Moon. I know it is, and I appreciate you holding. But we're just not going to go there tonight. We've got some other things we need to do, and it's an interesting theory, but I just can't go there. I'm just very sorry. Okay, let's go back to my unofficial co-host, Michael in Minnesota. Michael, do you have a question for Chief Kohler? And then I need to get to some of the questions that the people have been asking all week on both of the True Crime forums. Michael, go right ahead for Chief Kohler.
Well, Tricia, darling, you asked me to call in, so I did.
Oh, I thought you had more
so
questions.
I'm here to hang with you, and questions pop into my head, I'll tell you. But,
okay, then you just hang.
It's a very basic question I have at this point in the discussion that everyone has, I'm sure. Chief Kohler, do you believe we will ever have resolution in this case?
I sincerely doubt it. I don't think that anyone's going to be willing to come forward and share the truth about what happened. I'd be sincerely surprised if that were ever going to be the case.
Oh, that's just
who,
sad.
And that last caller, he kept referencing Jean Brody. Is this someone I need to know about or look into?
No.
Who Absolutely.
I disagree with this caller. This caller, he's a poster that's been around a long time, very smart person, just has a whole different theory than the rest of us, that it all had to do with the Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, which is a dramatic reading that Patsy Ramsey gave when she was, I don't know if it was a Miss West Virginia contest or the Miss America contest, and he's kind of tied it all together, and that is his opinion, and he's certainly right. He has every right to that opinion, but it's not one that we're going to go to tonight, that's for sure.
Okay, Chico, thanks, Patricia.
Let's talk a little bit about the ransom note. That, to me, that's the key piece of evidence. The DNA, you know what? The DNA, it's touch DNA. It is less than a cell of a skin, just one skin cell, just one. It's so degraded. It's nothing. We have more DNA under our fingernails right now than JonBenet had of supposedly her quote-unquote killer. So we're going to leave the DNA off the table here for a little bit and bring up the ransom note. Give us your thoughts on the ransom note, and please understand, I know you've talked about it till you're blue in the face, but there's still a lot of people out there that don't know. They don't know what happened in the JonBenet Ramsey case, and they think that the ransom note was written by an intruder. So help us clear that up.
Well, I think, first of all, there's never been, I don't think, any handwriting expert out there who's been able to say that definitively Patsy did not write it. There's been some varied opinions as to what degree people believe, what percentage they believe that she was responsible. But when you look at the linguistics, the textual formation, the grammar and those types of things, the language that was used, and coupling that with the actual physical handwriting of the letters and letter combinations, I feel pretty strongly that she wrote the note, not because she was covering up for a murder that she or an accident she herself had been involved in, because there was some type of cover-up going on. And I think there may be some additional handwriting analysis that may come out through some experts that are taking another look at the note, and I'd like to see exactly what their opinions are going to be. I have a pretty good idea based on conversations I've had with some folks, but I don't think it was left by an intruder at all. I think it was written by Patsy that night after she discovered her daughter's body.
Absolutely, and this case is not over, although I agree I don't think we'll have a resolution. There is still more information to come out, and the ransom note is definitely one of the keys, and that's something that you referenced, Chief Kohler, so we'll be waiting for that information. The ransom note has been destroyed, if I understand correctly. It had to be destroyed. I'm not even sure why. Something to do with the testing. Is that right?
Destroyed?
Yeah, it's not available anymore.
I understand the question. I don't think that's the case.
You don't? I thought it was. I thought the ransom note was just. Am I just up in the night here? Of course, that's an obvious question. His answer is yes. I thought it was destroyed in testing, but I could be absolutely. I hope not. I mean, I would love to be wrong about that.
No, it's not like a piece of DNA evidence or something that could be destroyed. I mean, you're going to have fingerprint analysis done with whatever variety of techniques, whether it be luminol or fingerprint dust, and then you've got the handwriting analysis. But I wouldn't suspect that the note has ever been destroyed. It's there and available to be seen.
Oh, I hope so. Was there ever? Oh, I'm sorry. Did you have something else?
Nope.
Okay. Okay, Michael in Minnesota, go ahead.
And again, you don't know this, Chief Kohler, but I really didn't follow this case. So while I was familiar about the note, I'm not familiar with the content of the note. What can you just summarize briefly, or Tricia, maybe you can too, what was in that note, the ransom or whatever it was?
Well, there's a number of different things about the note, not just the note itself, which was 2.5 pages, which was very lengthy, but also the pad upon which the note was written. A detective looking at the note that day when it was recovered from the scene, as well as an exemplar sample of Patsy's handwriting, a pad that was provided, he observed what he thought to be a practice note, where it was a few pages, I can't remember which side, before or after, where the note had been torn out. But and then there's some bleed through of some of the ink from pages of the note to other pages. And then the way that the note started out being kind of a formal tone, addressing, you know, Mr. Ramsey, and then toward, you know, towards the end of the note getting into kind of familiarization, knowing things about the family and perhaps John himself, and language that Patsy had used, spacing on the page of the paper, the way she would write things, all those different types of elements that came into play that, that pointed to her being the author of the note. And there were references as one of the guys was talking about
what was
movies,
the gist of the note? Lines. I'm sorry.
The gist of the note basically was, we have your daughter, and if you don't pay us $118,000, which was the exact amount of John Ramsey's bonus, we will kill her. If you talk to a dog, what does it say? We'll cut her head off. If you say anything, we'll cut her head off. Well, I can't remember the exact wording. And it says something about we respect you, Mr. Ramsey, but not the business you represent. And it had certain phrases in it, in the ransom note, that Patsy had used in other notes that they were able to collect. And that's what makes it so interesting. It's not just the actual writing itself, but the phraseology of the ransom note in the JonBenet Ramsey case also points to Ramsey. And then it says at the very end, SBTC, victory. Nobody's been able to figure out what that means, and I just think she just wrote that. It, Michael, it reads like somebody who's trying to write a ransom note, like she thinks a terrorist group would write a ransom note. Now, John Ramsey worked for basically the Lockheed Corporation. You have a terrorist note, ransom note found, and your daughter is gone, you would think that immediately you call the Lockheed Corporation. Well, there was no call. There was no... They have things in place that when something like this happens, they have a whole set of rules that they follow if there's some sort of terrorist attack, terrorist kidnapping. John Ramsey never made a phone call to his employer about it, and I just find that very interesting. But, Michael, I would absolutely suggest you and anybody listening, it is imperative you read that note and you understand each phrase, each sentence, because it is the biggest piece of evidence in the case. It's the absolute solid proof to me that there was no intruder. What intruder writes a practice note? He didn't bring the note with him. Yeah, and the thing is, usually a kidnapping note says, we have your daughter, don't call anybody or she's dead, wait for the phone call, end of story. This was 2.5 pages long. And,
but she's already dead in the basement. I don't even understand it.
Well,
it makes
that's
no
just,
sense.
There you go. So why would an intruder write a note and leave the body? You don't, unless you're trying to make it look like that. And you're not a criminal mind, you know, if you're not a criminal that knows how to do this, but you're trying to think like one, you're going to end up doing something like this. I do have some more questions from the forums. A lot of people have a lot of questions here, and I'll try and get to all of them as I can. The 911 call, Chief Kohler, this has been one of my many bones of contention. Burke Ramsey is supposedly heard on the 911 call, yet a version of the 911 call was released to the public. Do you know if the version that has Burke's voice on it was ever released to the public? We can hear Patsy. What happened was they called 911 and they thought they hung up the phone. And you can hear Patsy saying, help me, Jesus, help me, Jesus. You can hear that. I can hear that. But supposedly, through more investigation, through using certain equipment, you can hear Burke Ramsey say, you know, what's going on? What happened? And John Ramsey say, we're not talking to you. And they told the police that Burke was in bed asleep the whole time. So back to my very long-winded question, Chief Kohler, and I do apologize. Do you know if the 911 call that was released to the public is the one that has that section on it? Do you have any idea what was released?
I could not tell you. I do not know who released that or when it was released. I mean, obviously, I think it was done before my involvement in 2005. I know that there was a master disk in the investigative file, and I also obtained one from the California company that did the work on that case.
Right.
I'm not quite sure who released it. I know not long after the release of my book, I had some email correspondence with some folks that thought they heard other things on the tape, and I kept asking, well, what is the source that provided you with this call, and how do you know it's genuine? So I guess that may be my question. Who was it? What agency released the 911 tape to the public for that to be heard? Because I honestly don't know the answer to that.
So it's not original? Is that what you're saying?
Well, here's the thing. It was released to the public, and I think it was, I think it might have been the Ramseys, if I remember right. This is so long ago. I think it might have been Lynn Wood. Or maybe it was Mary Lacey. It was a Ramsey-friendly person that did it. And when it was when the 911 call was released, I actually personally just spent money and had it analyzed. And there was nothing on there. So the theory, there was no sound of Burke, let me put it that way. So the theory was, well, of course, they took it off. They wouldn't release that to the public. And nobody's been able to find out which version was released. If it really was the version that had Burke on it, or was it just such a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy that it got lost? I don't know. Chief Kohler, have you ever heard anything like Burke on the tape? Or can you say?
I've listened to what was a first version off the computer, and I have to tell you, I think my hearing has been so damaged over the years from too many years on the firearms range and not inappropriate, not using appropriate hearing protection. I just can't hear it.
But
I outline it in the book about how the investigator went to California and the two techs and she, independent of one another before they even gathered their heads together, all heard the same series of conversations between the three people on the end of that 911 tape.
Yeah, exactly. It was heard by investigators that went to the, I believe it was aerospace engineering, and forgive me if I'm wrong, like I said, it's been so long. And let's see, let me just run to the chat room really quickly. I've been ignoring our wonderful chatters here. Oh, let's talk about, if we're going to jump, like I said, just kind of hopscotch around, let's talk about the pineapple again for the moment. If I remember correctly, and this comes from one of our wonderful posters, UK in UK Guy on Web Sleuth, John and Patsy didn't initially talk about the pineapple. I mean, they've never mentioned the pineapple, correct? They don't know how, supposedly, they don't know how the pineapple got there. Is it possible that they didn't even know about the pineapple? Maybe this happened while they weren't looking.
Well, I think that that's the case. If I follow my theory of events, John went to bed pretty quickly after placing JonBenet in her bedroom. Burke was staying downstairs having some pineapple that his mom served him. JonBenet came downstairs. That's where a confrontation took place after she took a nibble. And then it wasn't until later that, she was discovered. And then it wasn't until after the autopsy results had returned that Dr. I can't remember his name off the top of my head, the pathologist who performed the procedure indicated that he'd found pineapple. And that was a pretty closely held secret for a while because the investigators at Boulder knew that the whites had not served pineapple at their dinner party. And Patsy adamantly denied serving pineapple to JonBenet that night when they got home from the party, but she couldn't recall serving pineapple to Burke. And one of her excuses was during her interview was that that's not the way she would set things up if she were going to serve pineapple to her son. Well, my thought was, she's not serving an Easter dinner party or something like that. It's just a snack at the end of the day when you come home from a long afternoon
sure.
partying at some friend's house, So that seemed to be a qualifying statement to me, but I don't believe that anyone knew that JonBenet had pineapple except perhaps Burke because he was there eating it at the same time. That's my speculation and theory.
And so that would make sense that John and Patsy didn't know about the pineapple, and they were one of the you know, times they were absolutely being truthful here. Oh, I'm getting texts with questions. Let's see here. Hold on. Let's see. Who is that? Ah, okay. Cherokee, I'm going to go to you here because I want you to ask this question because you are much more eloquent than I am. So hold on one second here. Let's see. Where are you? There we are. Okay, Cherokee, go right ahead. You have a question for Chief Kohler.
Well, I didn't. It wasn't exactly a question, but I did want to answer Michael's question in lieu and in to help what he asked Chief Kohler. The ransom note in its entirety is posted at one of your forums, www.forumsforjustice.com. If anyone wants to go there
.org.
And see it.
.org.
Sorry, .org. I'm sorry. Sorry.
That's okay.
I'm getting old. And .org. And along with that is my analysis, which includes a lot of things that Dr. Kohler, see, I'm getting really bad. Chief Kohler, now he's elevating to doctor.
Now he's a doctor.
Said about the linguistics, the Patsy U's that are similar, and the handwriting analysis and other things. It's all included there. So if they're curious and they've not really seen some of the evidence of how it was linked to Patsy, they can find it at forumsforjustice.org, and that would be
wonderful.
A good introduction if they're wanting to find that. And not trying to toot my own horn or anything. That's why I was just sending it to you so you could say it.
I want you to say it.
No. Not because I'm not. Because for people that don't know the case, or just kind of wondering, well, what was in that? Just as Chief Kohler said, it's linked alone. When the FBI and everyone else looked at it, said this is fake. This is not real at all. There is no intruder. Let's look at the family. I mean, that was one of the very first clues. And I'll tell you what the second clue is. The Ramseys have distanced themselves from the ransom note. Once it was linked to Patsy, they never mentioned it again. Now, you would think this is the their killer's calling card. This is the one thing that links whoever, you know, killed their daughter to the evidence. And yet they don't want to talk about it. All they want to talk about is this degraded, minuscule, less than minuscule, DNA that's not even a full complement that you could enter in CODIS originally. They had to work with it to get more going. And you would have to know, as someone, I do a DNA analysis done for genetics and different things, and they would require more than that just to even to do a sample. I mean, there's just so, I can't express to people how there was hardly any DNA there. It's just trace DNA, like it's on you and I, that's we're covered in it, and we rub up against something, touch DNA or whatever. But anyway, to go back to my original point, instead, the Ramseys focus on this bogus DNA stuff that eventually will find a killer. You know, that's always their that's their phrase for everything. Instead of focusing on the one thing that supposedly the killer wrote, which was the ransom note, and they don't want to talk about it. They never mention it. They act like it doesn't exist. Well, there's a reason for that, because it has Patsy all over it, linguistically, and with her handwriting and everything. And if, like I said, if someone wanted to see that in comparison, they can go to FSJ and find that. But I just wanted to mention that when he was talking, when Michael was asking about it and Chief Kohler was answering him, it's just so apparent. And that's one reason the FBI and their child unit, the investigative unit, said, look at the family. The same thing that Chief Kohler said after he went through all the evidence and said to Mary Lacy, let's look at the family, and she said no. No, we're not going to look at the family. She just flat put her foot, wouldn't even entertain the idea. Well, that's the same thing the FBI had said back in January of 1997. So obviously Chief Kohler was correct in what he came up with from looking at the evidence. It's the same thing the FBI said 15 years earlier. It's just that the people there in Boulder, the ones that were either in bed with the Ramseys, Hunter, Alex Hunter, and people like that, the DA, who would not subpoena records, who would not subpoena telephone records, and people like Mary Lacy, who became fast friends with the Ramseys, would entertain no thought of them being involved, no matter where the evidence led. I'm sorry, I'm on my high horse again. I know I'm preaching to the choir, but it just, when you look at the facts, and the people that look at the facts and the evidence, they always come back to look at the family.
Mm-hmm.
But yet the people in Boulder that were in charge of prosecuting or bringing that evidence to fruition would not charge the family, and would not charge. Now, I understand Burke was underage. If he's the one that was the assailant, then he cannot be prosecuted. But let's at least get the facts out there. Let's at least put the truth out there and quit chasing around a non-existent intruder and quit, you know, pretending like all this didn't happen and all the lives that they damaged in the meantime trying to protect their own. And that's the part that gets me. Yes, yes, I can see someone's protecting their son, whatever. But they damaged a lot of other people's lives and threw a lot of other people under the bus in trying to protect their own. And that's what I think needs to be revealed. But like it's like Chief Fuller says, I don't know that it ever will be, barring someone coming out with a confession, and we won't name names. It's not going to be. There's always going to be this, it's always going to be up in the air, and the intruder will never be found because he doesn't exist. And so there's the end of my
exactly. Chief Kohler,
did
you want
to jump in here, Tricia?
Yes, please.
I think she makes an excellent point, an excellent observation about the ransom note. And you see that as a red flag in a number of other instances. You know, I point out some of the inconsistencies with John Ramsey's statements over his discovery of this vicious suitcase and the stool or chair that was used to block the room down there. It's never mentioned initially, and when it is mentioned one time, it disappears from whatever other additional conversations, interviews, and book writing he does after that. And you have to wonder, why is this such an integral piece of the intruder theory? All of a sudden it disappears, you know, because it's inconsistent with someone coming either in or through that room on the day of a kidnapping and murder.
Yeah, I absolutely
excellent
agree.
Observation. Though.
Yeah, Cherokee is absolutely one of the best. Let's go to Cold Case. Cold Case, I have a feeling you are chomping at the bit, my darling.
I'm trying to keep my tongue in check here. Well, speaking to this ransom note, and I'm not sure, Chief Kohler, if you've ever really had the time or inclination to speculate on some of the issues involved in the many complexities of the ransom note, such as the way the thing begins. You know, we are a small foreign faction, which you brought up, and, you know, no, and so has everyone else, including Thomas, that they wouldn't identify themselves that way. But we have your daughter, and we're not against you, John Ramsey. We have no bone to pick with you, but the company you work for or the country you work for. And, you know, that brings up Lockheed Martin, a national defense contractor, you know, way at the top of the food chain in bureaucracy, international connections and business that, you know, most of us think of highly complex spy movies when we think of Lockheed Martin. And I once saw a documentary of a crime in which a man, his phone records were not allowed to be subpoenaed, even though the crime involved a private personal connection, a relationship of his. Because he did business with the government, his phone record subpoenas were quashed. And that made me think about that whole reference to, you know, it's your business. It's not your business or you, but it's the country you serve, because that immediately could throw this in that category. Because, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I'm always totally flabbergasted about these phone records. And if that was brought into play, you know, we say, well, John Ramsey didn't call Lockheed Martin, or, you know, well, how do we know? We don't know. And yes, it could have been a cell phone record, because in that 98 Haney interview with Patsy, she went into the longest song and dance about this lost cell phone that has just liar, liar, pants on fire all over it. So, long story, I know, but, you know, is that anything that you've thought about, that those connections, because of John's company, you know, being a subsidiary of Lockheed Martin, that somehow that played into the boondoggle that became this investigation?
That was the longest question in history, but it was a good one, I want to say. It was a very good one.
Well, you know, I've talked with you about this a lot, Tricia, but I've never brought it up before for this reason, because it's kind of complex.
I love it, though. We love it. We want complex. So please, Chief Kohler, the floor is yours.
Well, I think there's so many, as you say, complexities to the ransom note that you could spend probably a whole 3 hours talking about all the different things related to that. I think it was a hastily crafted note with, you know, one perhaps, maybe more initial headings that were done to try to get it written correctly. It was initially started out to be pointing towards a foreign faction involving, you know, John's employer, and it evolved into a personal. And, you know, I've asked around. I thought the joke or the comment about using his good Southern common sense or something like that was probably an inside family joke. That's my interpretation. That was known between he and Patsy and maybe a few others. I think that, you know, John recognized her handwriting. I think he recognized her phraseology, those types of things, and certainly the reference to his Southern common sense. And that's what kept him off guard all day long and puzzling about what was going on. And I think that was one of the reasons that he was so standoffish with police. And when he finally saw that the ransom call didn't come at 10 a.m., that's when he went exploring. And that's why he never told the police that he found JonBenet's body at 11 o'clock that morning, you know, 2 hours before one of the aunts started going through the house. So I think there's a lot to the ransom note that could be discussed. Like I say, I think it was prepared as a hasty cover-up for the events that took place that evening.
And I want to point out something, and this, again, is a hopscotch around here. For people who really think the Ramseys cooperated and told the truth, just one thing popped into my mind during this give and take with Chief Kohler and Cold Case. John Ramsey states that the morning before he found the body, he witnessed a van in the alley by his house. If you go to the Ramseys' house, there's a small alley between the houses. There's a white van. He never told the police. But he wrote about it in his book. There are so many instances like that. There was this big, huge question about a stun gun. Everybody thought for sure that it's not everybody, but the Ramsey, Team Ramsey, thought that there was a stun gun that was used. And but the only way to prove that would be to exhume JonBenet. And that would be very easy to do. It's not a pleasant thing. It's gruesome to think about. But if you exhume the body, you would be able to make sure that those were not stun gun marks. They're not. Trust me, they are not. But John and Patsy did not push for that at all. They said, let her rest. Now, I'm telling you, you talk to a parent of a murdered child, and if you said, hey, there is evidence on my child's body, and the way we can catch her killer is by exhuming her body, guess what? They're going to go for it. They're going to say yes, not let her rest and let the evidence stay there. The reason why they didn't push for an exhumation is because they knew there were no stun gun marks. It just gets so wild and out of control. And Chief Kohler, that's why your book is the book that I will, to my dying day, say, for God's sakes, people, get this book and read it. You can get it in Kindle now on Amazon.com. It's A Foreign Faction, Who Really Kidnapped JonBenet Ramsey. Michael, I'm going to go to you. Do you have any more questions, my dear, before I check in the chat room real quickly?
Well, as I hear this, and I hear about, it was obvious to me, obviously, that Patsy wrote that note, I'm convinced. Isn't that in itself a crime, tampering with evidence or hindering an investigation, whatever the crime would be? It seems like it's criminal in and of itself. So why would
Michael,
that
let me tell you, yes. Michael, let me just tell you, this is one of the most bungled cases, not necessarily by the police, but by the district attorney's office. They were in bed with the Ramseys and the Ramseys' lawyers immediately. They weren't going to charge them. It didn't matter. It didn't matter what they did. They weren't going to charge them. The Ramseys could get away with literally everything, as we have seen. They would never charge Patsy with anything. They wanted to help Patsy. They were kind to Patsy and wanted her to, you know, feel comfortable and didn't want to upset her by questioning her. I mean, it is so, when
Why?
You read the book,
Why?
When you, you know what, Chief Kohler, can you answer that? I can't. I don't know how to answer that. Why? Why did the DA's investigators want to make her feel so comfortable and not upset her and treat her with kit gloves? Can you answer that?
Can you answer my inquiry about it being, aren't those actions of hindering an investigation or tampering with evidence?
Michael, you've asked, there's a million questions there, and you're right. Chief Kohler, go ahead.
Well, you could look at obstructing an investigation. You could look at tampering with evidence. You could look at concealing death, or you could look also at accessory after the fact to a murder. You know, there's
right.
statute of limitations for those. And unfortunately, by the time I became the lead investigator in the case in 2005, the statute of limitations on those had run. So there's no possible criminal charge to be brought against the parents or anyone else involved in that aspect of the case at this date and time.
Oh yeah. Oh, Michael, if you think that is frustrating, just wait. Everybody that's listening that knows the case is just nodding their head going, oh boy, do people who are just getting into this case need to know? Because you will say, well, why didn't they do this? Why didn't they do that? And there really isn't an answer other than
can you answer that? Can you answer why everyone was either fearful or complicit with the Ramseys? Do you have any theory as to what was going on there?
I'm having a tough time understanding your modulation. It's kind of hard, Michael. I think I point out some of those things in my book about the relationship that the DA's office had with the defense bar. And I think sometimes it might have been a lack of experience with their trials. They were not going to trial very frequently. They were frequently involved in negotiated pleas, so they didn't have to go to trial and gain those experiences. I pointed out one of the things that I thought was sort of shocking, during one of the interviews, was that the DA's office had agreed not to pursue certain medical records in the case in the months leading up to the initiation of the grand jury. And that's not the first time that the DA's office has done that. They had done the same thing during a grand jury with the Thane Smyk investigation of the kid that was dating Robert Redford's
daughter
at the time, mm-hmm. back in the 80s. And that was an execution-style murder with a shotgun there in town. And a grand jury was convened, but prior to that, they had agreed not to ask certain questions of one of the key witnesses or more than the key witnesses. So when I saw that they had agreed not to pursue certain medical records, that's what, you know, kind of infuriated me as well, that those were some of the same tactics that were being played and not being pursued. And I think that was part of the agreement reached in order to get the grand jury going and getting the Ramseys back to the table again to do interviews.
Oh, Michael, you'll die. You need to read Steve Thomas's book, too. He was the lead investigator for the police department, and that really gives you another clear look into the DA's office and their little escapades with the Ramseys. You will end up throwing something through a window, trust me. Chief Kohler, here is a very tricky question. It's a bit of a landmine, and I don't want to make you feel uncomfortable. And I hope you know you can just say, hey, I'm not answering that. Back off, Jack, and I will be glad to. Okay? Burke, do you feel that there's any evidence whatsoever that perhaps Burke was some sort of a victim, and I'm not quite sure how to define that other than perhaps he was not getting what he needed as a child. I'm not talking about he was beaten, he was, you know, starved, he was abused. Do you think there was something else going on with him with Burke in that family dynamic?
You know, I think the parents love both their children dearly and would do anything for them. I don't believe that there's any type of physical or sexual abuse taking place with Burke. You know, as I pointed out in one of the chapters, I think it was Enigma, he was at a pretty young age when his mom went through the first bout with cancer. And I think that that was probably very difficult for him, not maybe understanding all the circumstances. I could think there might be some attachment issues. His dad, by all accounts, seemed to be kind of a workaholic. Dad was always very busy. Not that he didn't spend quality time with his kids and with Burke, but as JonBenet was growing older and the female women in the family were spending a lot of time on pageantry things, it seemed to me that he might have been a very lonely little boy. not abused in any sense of the matter, but maybe feeling ostracized based on all the attention that his sister might have been receiving. And so, that could have fed into some of the jealousy or some of the things that were going on between he and his sister from time to time. So those are just some of the thoughts and theories that I was considering as I looked at family motivation and such.
Can you describe to us about a picture of Burke? I believe it was it the day of the crime when they came down to the police station or the day after? Is that something that you're able to talk about?
Well, I speak to that in one of the chapters on the book as a red flag, if I remember.
Yes.
This is on Saturday when the family had responded to the police department to provide handwriting samples and DNA samples. And Polaroid photograph was taken of Patsy, John, and Burke, all separately. And as I described in my viewing of those pictures, Patsy, you could hardly recognize her. Her hair was pulled back. She looked very distraught and forlorn, obviously, hardly the woman that you'd recognize in some of the other pictures of her. John seemed the same way. And then Burke was sitting there. His arm was kind of casually draped over a chair or a nearby table, and he smiled into the camera. It struck me as very, very odd, given all the circumstances that were coming into play that weekend after his sister had been murdered, that he'd be smiling and perking up to the camera. It struck me as very strange.
Yeah, I think it's very chilling. We do have a question from the chat room. And Chief Kohler, we're going to be wrapping this up in a little bit. You've given us so much of your time, and you're so generous. There was a Samsonite luggage found against the window in the basement. The window was open. That's where they said the intruder came in. Do you remember what was in that suitcase and if it has any significance at all in this case whatsoever?
I think there was a duvet found inside the suitcase. I don't think that it had anything to do with the crime. I don't think it had anything to do with any of the staging. There was no mention of this until after Lou Smith had entered the investigation in March of that year, 1997. And the suitcase wasn't mentioned by John Ramsey until after Lou had entered the investigation and proposed the theory about intruder coming through that window and using the suitcase as a stepping point. And I think there might have been a question about whether or not that might have been the weapon used for the blow, but I think that was possible.
Yeah, I think
it would not have created the type of injury on JonBenet's skull.
Right. Good question, though.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we do have, let's see. Oh, there we go. Oh, that was a question. How are your people, first of all, people appreciate what you have done, because let me just say this, and you don't say this, but I think it's important. This was not put out by a publisher. You had to pay for it yourself. This is not about making money, obviously, but we certainly hope that you are selling books. How are the book sales?
They've trickled off considerably in the last few months. There are still some minimum sales. The Kindle release, which took place in early June, has helped a little bit. There have been some sales. I haven't seen what those last numbers are. The report for that won't come up until the middle of the month.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm a long way from recapturing my investment for publishing this on my own.
You are a long way from it, you say?
Yes, yes.
Well, hopefully we'll be able to change that. And I want people to know that there was no ulterior motive here. Chief Kohler gave up a lot to write this book and to get the truth out. Now that it's on Kindle, you go to Amazon.com. The name of the book is Foreign Faction, Who Really Kidnapped JonBenet. We're going to go around the table one more time and see if any of our wonderful good time, great callers have any other questions. Cherokee, final questions for Chief Kohler.
I just want to make a final comment that I appreciate what he has given up and what he has done in bringing the truth of what he knows to the case, and that his book answered a lot of questions that we've had through the years. And it also helped whenever we found out that the grand jury had indicted the Ramseys, and within another week or so, the case died down in the news and they were off to something else. Nobody really cared. If that couldn't resurrect it, then nobody could. So I'm so glad that Chief Kohler got the truth down in a book so that later, you know, people who want to know the truth can find it instead of what is put out in the press and by the Ramseys, and they do not research. They just read from a cue card and copy and paste from each other, and he actually put the truth out. I just want to tell him again how much I appreciate that.
Thank you. And I want to say, Trisha, before you move on, I opened up Web Sleuths and or Forum for Justice. I see that someone has pasted some of the PowerPoint presentation I made during a library presentation last fall, and I think those are always very intriguing to see when you look at stun gun versus something else. So
exactly. So go to forumsforjustice.org and you can see those YouTube videos from a discussion that Chief Kohler did, and it will be eye opening. Let's go to Cold Case. Cold Case, my darling, wonderful friend. Talk to me. Final thoughts, comments for Chief Kohler.
Okay. I have a quick question for Chief Kohler. Do you know if the pink pajama bottoms that JonBenet had on the morning of Christmas in that last few photos we've seen of her, and the pink top is on her bed in the crime scene pictures, was the pink bottom ever found by law enforcement?
I could not tell you if it was or not.
Hmm.
It's always been a mystery.
It has. Okay. And is that everything? I don't want to cut you off. I want to give you a chance.
Well, there is one more. These are little questions that we've pondered and argued about and been teased with for so many years. Is it possible, Chief Kohler, that you remember the name of the Dr. Seuss book in that suitcase with that duvet in the basement? That's just a little trivia thing that drives me nuts.
Nope, I couldn't tell you that either. Sorry.
Okay, well, okay. I do appreciate what you do share with us, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Michael, any final thoughts for Chief Kohler before we wrap it up?
No, just again, I wanted to show my support, so I did buy your book. I'm sorry I haven't read it, so I could have been more well-versed tonight. But thank you, as everyone else has indicated, and this has been very enlightening to me, someone who really didn't follow the Ramsey case and know so little. I had told Trish I wouldn't even call in. But I'm glad I did, and I'm glad I participated, and I will read your book, and I think I'll even order a hardcover just to help you out further. I don't know what else I can do.
Thank you, Michael. And Michael, that's a great thing, too, is all of us in our group here that have been together for 17 years or whatever, we know all this, all of these little things, and we forget there are people, millions of people out there that don't know the ins and outs. And that's why, Michael, I'm glad you were here, because you were able to bring that up, like the ransom note and things like that. And that's why Chief Kohler's book is so important. It's to get it in the hands of the people that haven't read.
I cannot understand when you spoke, Chief Kohler, about the statute of limitations had run out on any charges that could have been brought against the Ramseys. I thought in case of murder there was no statute of limitations, but the accessory to the crime of murder has a statute of limitations. That just doesn't seem just at all to me.
You know, there is no statute of limitations for murder if you are the actual perpetrator, but accessory after the fact, under Colorado law, it's 3 years. If you leave the state, then it's stayed by another 5. So 8 years after the fact, if you haven't brought charges, then the capability of the prosecuting officer's offices to move forward is not possible. So
there you go. Yeah. There are your questions.
So sad there will never be justice. So
I know.
Sad.
It's very frustrating. You've just stepped into an Alice in Wonderland type situation where you'll be going, what? I just fell down a rabbit hole when you start reading some of this stuff, Michael. Trust me. Chief Kohler, thank you once again. You go to Amazon.com, and the name of the book is A Foreign Faction, Who Really Kidnapped JonBenet. Chief Kohler, you've written this book for all the right reasons, and we're here to support you any way we can. And hopefully we'll be doing a Christmas show, and I think we'll have a little bit more information, a little bit some newer things to talk about. We had a few things this time. We'll have some more as the Christmas season rolls around, as we talk about continuing to talk about the JonBenet Ramsey case. Chief Kohler, you know how I feel. Thank you very, very much for coming on tonight.
All right. Well, thanks for the invitation. I've enjoyed it.
Take care now. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
There you go. Chief James Kohler, Telluride, one of the coolest people I know, a man who is upstanding and is as honest as they come. He wrote the book for all the right reasons, because he wanted to see justice. He wanted to see justice, but he also wanted to make sure that somebody had a book out there that was current, that had the true facts, and that had what he experienced as lead investigator in the DA's office. And no amount of spin by Lynn Wood, the Ramsey attorney, by any of the former DAs, Mary Lacey, Alex Hunter, no amount of spin, tap dancing, whatever, can erase those words. And that is the beauty of the book. Thank you, Chief Kohler. You're just absolutely amazing. I can't say that enough. Next Sunday, we have a very strange case we're going to talk about. You'll remember it. When we get into the details, you're going to remember this. It's baby Melissa McGowan. Now, a family friend walked out of the house with her in her arms when she was just 7 months old. She came back 10 minutes later without baby Melissa. That was 26 years ago. Melissa's mother is desperately trying to get her daughter's face out there. Of course, we have an age progression photo that we'll show. There is a cold case detective that's been assigned to the case. But you know what? We're going to go on it next week on Trisha's True Crime Radio, so be sure and join us. And it's brought to you by your local no-kill animal shelter. Go to www.nokillnetwork.org and find your local no-kill shelter. You could do something as easy as volunteering an hour a week to help out. That's www.nokillnetwork.org. Opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests. Do remember that, please. Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from WebSleuths.com, LLC, and ForumsForJustice.org. In other words, my darling angels, if you get all upset about something you hear on Trisha's True Crime Radio, you don't go to the forums. You come to me, and we'll do our best to make you happy. It's Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we discuss true crime and current events, and we always do it with common sense. Good night, everyone.